Education is a process involving two sets of participants who supposedly play different roles: teachers who impart knowledge to students, and students who absorb knowledge from teachers. In fact, as every open-minded teacher discovers, education is also about students imparting knowledge to their teachers by challenging the teacher's assumptions and by asking questions that the teachers hadn't previously thought of. I recently repeated that discovery when I taught a course on how societies cope with environmental problems to highly motivated undergraduates at the University of California at Los Angeles. My first lecture was on the collapse of Easter Island society. In the class discussion after I had finished my presentation, the apparently simple question that most puzzled my students was one whose actual complexity hadn't sunk into me before. How on earth could a society make such an obviously disastrous decision as to cut down all the trees on which it depended? One of the students asked what I thought the islander who cut down the last palm tree said as he was doing it. They also asked the related question, how often did people wreck ecological damage intentionally, or at least while aware of the likely consequences? How often did people instead do it without meaning to, or out of ignorance? My students wondered whether, if there are still people left alive 100 years from now, those people of the next century will be as astonished about our blindness today as we are about the blindness of the Easter Islanders. My UCLA undergraduates have identified a baffling phenomenon, namely failures of group decision-making on the part of whole societies or other groups. Individuals, too, make bad decisions. They enter bad marriages, they make bad investments and career choices, their businesses fail, and so on. But some additional factors enter into failures of group decision-making, such as conflicts of interest among members of the group and group dynamics. This is obviously a complex subject to which there would not be a single answer fitting all situations. What I'm going to propose instead is a roadmap of factors contributing to failures of group decision-making. I'll divide the factors into a fuzzily delineated sequence of 4 categories. The first stop on my roadmap is that groups may do disastrous things because they failed to anticipate a problem before it arrived, for any of several reasons. One is that they may have had no prior experience of such problems. A prime example is the mess that British colonists created for themselves when they introduced foxes and rabbits from Britain into Australia in the 1800s. Even prior experience is not a guarantee that a society will anticipate a problem if the experience happened so long ago to have been forgotten. For instance, Chaco Canyon Anasazi Society survived several droughts before succumbing to a big drought in the 12th century AD. But the earlier droughts had occurred long before the birth of any Anasazi affected by the big drought, which would thus have been unanticipated because the Anasazi lacked writing. In modern literate societies, we don't necessarily draw on prior experience committed to writing. We, too, tend to forget things. For a year or two after the gas shortages of the 1973 Gulf oil crisis, we Americans shied away from gas-guzzling cars. But then we forgot that experience and are now embracing SUVs. When the city of Tucson in Arizona went through a severe drought in the 1950s, its alarmed citizens swore that they would manage their water better, but soon returned to their water-guzzling ways of building golf courses and watering their gardens. Another reason why a society may fail to anticipate a problem involves reasoning by false analogy. For instance, when Viking colonists encountered in Iceland many of the same tree species already familiar to them from Norway and Britain, they were deceived by the apparent similarity of the landscape. Unfortunately, Iceland's soils arose not through glacial grinding, but through winds carrying light ash blown out in volcanic eruptions. Once the Vikings had cleared Iceland's forest to create pastures for their livestock, the light soil became exposed, and much of Iceland's topsoil soon eroded away. The second stop on my roadmap involves a society failing to perceive a problem that has actually arrived. There are at least 3 reasons for such failures. First, the origins of some problems are literally imperceptible. For example, the nutrients responsible for soil fertility are invisible to the eye. There was no way for the first colonists of Australia to perceive the problem of soil nutrient exhaustion. Another frequent reason for failure to perceive a problem is distant managers, a potential issue in any large society or business. For example, the largest private landowner and timber company in Montana today is based 400 miles away in Seattle, Washington. Not being on the scene, company executives may not realize that they have a big weed problem on their forest properties. Perhaps the commonest circumstance under which societies fail to perceive a problem is when it takes the form of a slow trend concealed by wide up-and-down fluctuations. The prime example in modern times is global warming. Climate fluctuates up and down erratically from year to year. 3 degrees warmer in one summer than in the previous one. Then 2 degrees warmer the next summer. Down 4 degrees the following summer. Down another degree the next one. Then up 5 degrees, etc. With such large and unpredictable fluctuations, it has taken a long time to discern the average upwards trend of 0.01 degrees per year within that noisy signal. Politicians use the term creeping normalcy to refer to such slow trends concealed within noisy fluctuations. If anything is deteriorating only slowly, it's difficult to recognize that each successive year is on the average slightly worse than the year before. So one's baseline standard for what constitutes normalcy shifts gradually and imperceptibly. Another term related to creeping normalcy is landscape amnesia, forgetting how different the surrounding landscape looked 50 years ago, because the change from year to year has been so gradual. I suspect that landscape amnesia provided part of the answer to my UCLA student's question, "What did the Easter Islander who cut down the last palm tree say as he was doing it?" We unconsciously imagine a sudden change. One year, the island still covered with a forest of tall palm trees. The next year, just a single tree left, which an islander proceeds to fell in an act of incredibly self-damaging stupidity. Much more likely, though, the changes in forest cover from year to year would have been almost undetectable. Yes, this year we cut down a few trees over there, but saplings are starting to grow back again here. Gradually, Easter Island's trees became fewer, smaller, and less important. At the time that the last fruit-bearing adult palm tree was cut, the species had long ago ceased to be of any economic significance. That left only smaller and smaller palm saplings to clear each year, along with other bushes and treelets. No one would have noticed the falling of the last little palm sapling. By then, the memory of the valuable palm forest of centuries earlier had succumbed to landscape amnesia.